of destroying the second of the gates. With half of the four gates destroyed, it would be months before their fighter could gather enough ore to replace the enormous iron barriers, which had previously taken a year each to construct. By then it was almost certain that the north would be in a position to march on the south. Pincered between the north and Calip, Fanes would surely fall. As planned, they reached the second gate just as the sun goddess slipped below the horizon, spraying the sky with her final gift, flowers of purple, red, and pink. They descended the staircase above the gate, and once more Fire placed her palms, fingers splayed, on the thick metal, which bore an intricate design of the four-eyed lioness. Her hands glowed red, the heat and colour emanating outwards, superheating the metal until it began to drip red-hot tears. Fire danced back, joining Raven and the rest of the Guanero who were silently watching, many of them with their swords, scimitars, and whips raised high in support of the Empress.
"Arr!"
Goggin roared, a war cry of victory. Many echoed his call. "We should retreat," Raven said. "We have accomplished what we set out to do, and there are many leagues between here and the spear." Fire said, "Hemptown is due south of here." "Exactly," Raven said. "The army at Susa will have sent word already. They'll be preparing a counterattack. If we race along the wall, we may be able to escape before they cut us off." Fire shook her head. "We haven't lost more than a 20th of our force. We have marched far. I will not waste this opportunity." "Waste it? You have destroyed two of the great Southron gates. The day is won. Accept victory where you have achieved it." "Here is my command," Fire said. "I will ride south with the Guanero. You will lead the rest of the army back across the spear to the Skara. May we meet again in Kesh with its famed hospitality." "Fire, no," Raven said. "I cannot leave you. I will not." "Will you deny my command, sister? That is treason." "Then I choose death," Raven said without hesitation. Though she hadn't exactly grown closer to Fire on this journey, she felt she understood her more. She knew what her sister was doing, what she was risking. She couldn't let her do it alone. Fire sighed. "You need to return to Calypso. If I don't return, you will rule. We cannot let it fall on Whisper's shoulders." In the end, the decision was taken out of both their hands as Goggin cried, "Incoming soldiers!" Raven and Fire turned their gazes to the south, where an army was running northward. This was no small counterforce, but a formidable army at least twice their size. The soldiers wore armor plate painted black and red like the massive desert paisans Fanes was known for. They ran, not in formation, but in small groups, weaving in and out of each other in a classic Phoenician manner designed to confuse the enemy. "Sister, hear reason," Raven pleaded. "We can still retreat. Our soldiers are made stronger from this journey. We can outrun them." "I will not run," Fire said, her eyes dancing with flames. Raven had known her sister long enough to realize when her mind was made up. "There is only one choice left." "Yes," Fire said. "We fight." "May I?" Fire nodded. "On my command," Raven said, raising her whip in the air. The wind seemed to stop, as if holding its breath along with the soldiers. "Charge!" The foot soldiers, in classic Calypsian diamond formation, led the rush across the desert lands, the earth cracking under their heavy trod. The Guanero filled in the hollow center of the diamond, holding back for the initial wave to make contact. Arrows fell amongst them, but even the Phoenicians seemed to prefer a hand-to-hand clash, which meant most of the enemy were probably masters of Fenru. And then, like two great waves colliding on an ocean of sand, the two armies came together, thousands of men and women locked in a battle that would be recorded by the survivors in the annals of history. A blade of enemies burst through their ranks, fighting like wildcats in the typical Phoenician manner, furious and without abandon, powdered white faces flashing in the dying light. There were no slaves amongst them, which supported Raven's belief that her father was building up his slave army in the heart of the empire, Phoenia. The Phoenicians performed Fenru backflips and frontflips and even sideflips, attacking acrobatically. Their thin boots were strapped with blades, and they aimed deadly kicks at throats and chests. Knives were tied to their wrists, and when they raked their fists through the air, steel flashed. Dozens of Calypsians fell under the onslaught. Raven swung her whip, lashing it across the eyes of one soldier who tried to leap at her wielding a bladed staff. He howled, clutching his eyes and falling, where he was cut down by Goggin as the large man rode past. The Guanic snapped and clawed at the Phoenician horses, which were mighty steeds, at least twice as large as the typical Western horses. The stallions, which were also painted red and black, kicked back, refusing to back down. Fire was a tornado of fiery fury, slashing her inflamed sword at any who came close, while simultaneously launching fireballs into pockets of the enemy. A group of archers targeted her, but she melted their arrowheads and charred the wooden shafts as the darts flew through the air. Another fireball wiped out the lot of them. Raven's reptilian steed, Ichnon, barreled forward, trampling a soldier who screamed as he was crushed underfoot, while Raven cracked her whip once more, curling it around the neck of a man, yanking him off his feet. With a quick snap of her wrist, she flung a knife through his throat. As the battle continued, Raven lost sight of her sister, though evidence of fire's power was everywhere. Piles of human ash, half-melted swords and shields, fireballs arcing across the sky. Where fire went, death followed. Night fell, and still the armies battled, until there were more dead than living, a mixture of alternating dark and pale faces staring up at the sky with empty eyes. Raven and Ichnon were forced to pick their way carefully across the killing fields, searching for enemy combatants. Her leg was bleeding profusely where she'd taken a slash from a rider's sword. Ichnon was covered in blood too, both human, horse, and Guanic, though Raven wasn't sure whether any of it was his. Raven pulled her mount to a halt, her eyes searching the gloom for any sign of fire. There were many fires burning, but none moving. Occasionally steel rang against steel, and voices cried in pain and battle, but they died away more quickly, until they were few and far between. Other shadows moved across the landscape, some heading south, surviving Phoenicians, retreating to Hemptown or beyond. Raven marveled at the fact that they seemed to have won, despite their much smaller force. It was a testament to their strict training regime, as well as the advantage fire's power gave them. Goggin appeared before her, looking much like a monster, with a long slash across his face and his missing ear. One arm dangled limply from his side, broken. Still, he held one scimitar in his other hand. For once, his expression was grim. "Where is the Empress?" Raven asked, dismounting. Goggin shook his head.
"Not sure," he grunted. "Last I saw her, she was off yonder. She was battling many foes."
"And winning, no doubt," Raven said, her words far more certain than the fear roiling through her gut. "If she is dead, I would feel it," Raven thought, assuring herself. "With me, Commander." Goggin followed her as she moved in the direction he'd last seen fire. "So many dead," Raven murmured.
"War is death," Goggin said.
"This was supposed to be a mission, not a war."
"These days, they're the same thing."
They found fire ringed by dead enemy soldiers. She was lying on the ground, staring up at the stars. Several of the red gods were blazing across the sky, much like they had on that night Raven had sat beside her in the desert. A blade was embedded in fire's stomach, her fingers clasped around it as if in prayer.
"Sister,"
fire said when she saw Raven kneel beside her.
"Don't speak," Raven said, her heart sinking into her gut. "We need to bind your wounds. Can you melt the sword from within?"
Her hands trembled as she tore at her own clothing beneath her leather armor. Fire shook her head.
"I have no strength left." And then, "I'm glad you're alive. Keep Whisper safe. Defeat Fata. Reclaim the South. Honor me."
"You can honor yourself," Raven said.
"I go to the gods.
Watch for me amongst the stars."
"No, I'm going to get you help. We brought healers with us for this very purpose. If any are alive. I have played my part, sister. Now it's time for you to play yours."
Raven cried out as her sister's skin began to burn.
She stumbled backward, but Goggin caught her with one strong arm, picking her up and carrying her away. She screamed and punched and kicked at him, but he held her fast, his feet sure and steady as he weaved through the sea of dead. Eventually Raven stopped fighting, her body shaking with grief, though her eyes were dry. Finally Goggin set her down, steadying her with his hand, preventing her from collapsing. A fire blazed amongst the carnage, as high as a funeral cairn. And then it exploded, the flames as white as the noonday sun, washing over the battlefield like a dust storm, licking at the bodies, consuming them in its heat. Instinctively, Raven and Goggin ducked, huddling together as the fire flowed over them, somehow never touching or burning them, an inferno all around. It was like being in a fire, but protected by some unseen force. Unseen, but not unknown. Fire, Raven thought. Fire protects us, even as she dies.
Oh, gods!
She wailed, because now she felt it. The hole inside her, the missing piece of her heart, the blank space in the world where fire used to be. The tears finally came, dripping into the unburning flames. The sparks soared into the night sky, thousands of fireflies spreading on the wind. The grass of the forbidden plains caught first, the brittle plants tinder for the unnatural flames. Next was the tangle, which began to burn like a bonfire. Though the east and the west had long been separated by war, hatred, and fear, it was now split in half by fire. Few of the enemy had survived on the battlefield south of the Southron Gates. The war cities of Susa and Hemptown were decimated, depleted of their armies because of fire's final act. Even in death she was the weapon she had promised to be. As for the Calypsians, Raven and Goggin now led the survivors, a force of 300 strong. 1/10, she thought. If she hadn't seen the bodies herself, she wouldn't have believed it. Of those 300, almost a third were too injured to walk, which meant every 2 soldiers had to carry another between them. The only positive was that the Guanero had defied the odds, more than half of the Guanic riding warriors and their steeds surviving the battle. It was slow going, the journey back to the spear taking twice as long in reverse, especially because small bands of Phoenicians harried them with arrows shot from the wall from time to time. Each time a band appeared, Raven and Goggin were forced to halt the retreat, fight to the top of the wall, and kill them. It was slow and gruesome work, and they lost another 26 lives while doing it. Eventually, however, the spear appeared, a gossamer thread of liquid steel. On the other side they rested, cleaned and dressed their wounds, and ate. Raven sat on the riverbank with her head in her hands. She felt cold inside, like fire had taken all of her warmth when she'd passed on to the next world. Goggin sat near her, not speaking, understanding her need for silence. The large man was proving to be far more perceptive than Raven had ever given him credit for. She sat like that for a long time, thinking about her mother, about fire, and finally about Whisper. Thinking of Whisper hurt the most, because Raven knew she would be heartbroken. She wondered whether she should have fought fire harder when they were planning this mission, persuaded her to wait, to consider other options. But no. Once fire's mind was made up, changing it was like trying to stop a storm. I loved her for that, Raven thought. She never realized it until now. The spear burbled swiftly downstream, and Raven wondered what it would be like to jump in, to let the current carry her into the burning sea, never to return. Whisper needs me, she said aloud. It was a reminder to herself that though Fire's life was over, hers was not.
We all need you, Goggin said.
Raven flinched. She had forgotten the Guanero commander was still sitting with her, his presence like a calming breeze. Raven shook her head. Calip is broken.
That's where you're wrong, Goggin said. Calip was not your mother, or Fire, or even you. Calip is more than any person, even an empress. Calip is a proud nation, home to thousands of souls who depend on us to protect them. And, just like your sister was, Calip is as strong as ever.
Raven was about to respond, to thank Goggin for speaking the words she needed to hear, when a shout arose. She swiveled around, craning her head toward the side, noticing a shadow moving across the dunes of the Skara. She squinted, gazing at the sky, where a bird angled their way. Wait. It was too large to be a bird, and getting larger by the second.
Dragon!
Goggin breathed, and Raven knew he was right. It was one of the largest in the brood, Heron, a black, sinewy creature with an addiction to bacon spiced with mixer. Raven had grown up with him. He was hatched when she was but 5 years old. Based on the side-to-side style of flight, Raven also knew who the rider was. Rider, the Dragon Master, a black cloak flapping in the wind. While the entire camp watched, Heron unfurled his wings and circled twice, finally swooping down to land with impressive grace beside Raven. She couldn't help the laugh that bubbled from her lips, though her eyes sparkled with tears. Heron, who seemed to be grinning a razor-sharp grin, nuzzled against her hand when she held it out. Though the dragon was larger than any 10 of the Guanic put together, he was still at least a year away from full maturity. And the next year would be his biggest growth spurt yet, a thought that still made Raven marvel. Ryder slid off her mount, her dark eyes laced with concern. Unlike the dragon, she was not grinning. Without Raven needing to say a word, Ryder strode up to her and embraced her. Raven's tears soaked the woman's cloak. When Raven pulled back, Ryder said, "I'm so sorry." Though the woman, who was 12 years Raven's elder, had a sharp, angular face, her expression was full of compassion. "How did you know?" "From your face. And from a distance I saw how small your force had become. I feared the worst." "So Whisper doesn't know yet?" "How could she?" Raven nodded. "It is better that I am the one to tell her. Now tell me, Ryder, why have you crossed the desert on Dragonback?" The compassion slipped from Ryder's face, replaced by a frown. "Grian Ironclad has turned his attention away from the north." Raven raised an eyebrow. "That surprises me. His father and brother were killed at Raider's Pass, his eldest brother injured. Surely he seeks revenge." "We've received numerous streams in the last fortnight, since you've been gone."
"Saying what?"
"The north lost the bulk of its forces in the Bay of Bounty."
"What?"
Raven had understood the words perfectly, but she couldn't make sense of them. Their entire plan to destroy half of the Southron gates was built on the notion that the north would decimate the west and then march on Fanes. Ryder nodded. "It's true. Two other messages confirmed it. Evidently Queen Rhea is more formidable an enemy than anyone expected. It is said she summoned a monster of the sea." "So the north has fallen at last. What of Lord Griswold and Castle Hill?"
Raven was still trying to process the news, what it all meant.
The self-declared King Regent raised a final army of superhuman warriors using some kind of a potion. 100 men who became monsters. But they were struck down by Queen Anise Garrick and her army of rebels, striving to take back the crown. It seems they did. Raven shook her head. Two queens, two mighty victories. She wondered what it might mean for her chances as empress. Other than her mother, the Four Kingdoms had long been ruled by men.
"At what cost?"
she asked. "Anise lost all but a handful of soldiers, though her brother remains unconscious from the battle at Raider's Pass. If not for two great warriors, she might have lost the day."
"What warriors?"
"A giant known as the Armored Knight, and a great swordsman, a Sir Dietrich."
"So Queen Garrick has nothing left?"
"Correct. There are rumors that she fled north into the hinterlands."
"What is there?"
"Snow, ice, nothing. She is the least of your concerns." Raven realized the conversation had come full circle, and that Ryder had been holding something back the whole time, building to this point, or perhaps delaying the topic altogether.
"You said King Ironclad has turned away from the north."
"Meaning what? That he's moving south?" Ryder shook her head.
"Not moving south. He's already south, along with most of his troops. Without the north to defend against, he's shifted forces from Norris, Crow's Nest, and Glee."
Raven closed her eyes.
She'd barely had a day to grieve the loss of her sister, and already reality was knocking at her door. When she opened them again, she asked, "What are you not telling me?" Ryder grimaced, as if the next topic was too distasteful to broach. "We received a stream from Kesh as well. Several, actually." "Guta?" She nodded. "He's completed his investigation into the assassination attempt on fire." "And?" "The assassin was paid in iron shields. Hundreds of them were discovered in her personal effects." "The East was plotting an assassination for 2 years." "It appears that way." "Why us? Why not the West?" "Perhaps they have paid assassins in many places. The ironclads have always had a long memory." Raven gritted her teeth. "So do the Sands."
42. The Crimean Sea, somewhere south of the Dead Isles. Grey Aris. Grey felt warm and dry. He released a sigh of contentment. All the pain and fear were gone, swept away by death and whatever came after. He opened his eyes to sunlight spilling through a portal window. Beyond the window, there was blue sky. It was moving. No, rocking. He could feel everything rocking, swaying, gently moving side to side. The bed beneath wasn't particularly soft. And the pain wasn't gone, after all. No, he could feel it in the aches in his joints and a strange numbness in his fingertips. He raised his left arm to find his hand still gone, but wrapped in fresh bandages. "I'm not dead," he whispered. Someone giggled, and he flinched, turning to follow the sound. A pair of sparkling brown eyes, set in a cute brown face topped with a spill of unruly ringlets, stared at him.
"No, you're not dead, Grey Aris. Not today."
"Kyla? But how?"
She sat in a chair by his bedside, an open book on her lap. And the way the sun was hitting her face, Grey lost his breath for a moment. "We went back to find you," she said matter-of-factly.
"But your father, the captain, it was his idea, believe it or not. We sailed south for half a day, and all Dav did was pace the deck the whole time. Then, finally, he commanded the men to turn the ship around and make for the Dead Isles. I think half of them soiled their pants when he gave the order." She laughed lightly. Grey shook his head in wonderment. He knew the captain's superstitions, how he believed bringing a ship near the Isles would mean certain death. And yet he'd gone anyway. To help him. To save him. Kyla continued. "Night had fallen, but he refused to sleep, manning the winches himself, steering the ship all on his own. I'd already had plenty of rest after. Well, I wasn't tired anyway, so I kept lookout. I spotted you floating there in the water, and at first I thought you were dead, but then you lifted a hand. Well, not a hand, but your..." She gestured to his stump. "Arm. And so I shouted to Dar, who roused the men. They lowered him to the water with ropes, and he grabbed you and your sister, Shay. She's fine. She's up on deck, telling stories to the men. They're already very fond of her. She smiles more than you ever did." Grey swung his feet over the side of the bed and tried to stand up, but everything spun and he fell back down. "Whoa there, hold on," Kyla said, resting a hand on Grey's chest to hold him back. "From the way Shay tells it, you've had a hell of an ordeal. You need to rest." Grey waited for the ship to stop spinning, and then placed his hand on top of Kyla's. It felt so natural, so easy, like the touch of someone he'd known his entire life. "Thank you," he said. Kyla's lips parted slightly, an amused smile playing on their curves. "For what? It was Dar who gave the orders." "For being here when I woke up. For waiting for me." Kyla smiled and leaned toward him. His heart raced as her soft brown lips opened further. She whispered in his ear, "It's a really good book, and I didn't want to put it down," she said, pulling back and holding up the novel she'd been reading. "A love story, actually.
There's this princess and this pauper, and, of course, they fall madly in love. But then everything goes wrong, and currently it seems they're both doomed to be apart.
Grey laughed and said, "Sounds like real life." He remembered what he'd felt for Rhea, but how he'd screwed everything up because of his selfishness and bravado, his arrogance.
"Perhaps. But I've read this one 1,000 times, so I already know there's a happy ending."
Grey felt warmth on his cheeks, and it wasn't because she'd told him the book's ending. No, it had nothing to do with the book, which was pure fiction. It had to do with the girl sitting in front of him, the feel of her hand in his, and what he knew he was about to do. He leaned forward and kissed her. At first she froze, her mouth flat and lifeless against his, and he wondered whether he'd made a grave mistake, but then she responded, her lips moving like gentle waves lapping against a shore. This kiss was so different to how it had been with Rhea, so much more tender, slower, like they had all day to finish it. And yet he could feel the passion, like an electric current running through his veins, his heart galloping like 1,000 horses. Neither of them pulled away so much as there was a gradual, natural separation when the beautiful, perfect first kiss had finished. Grey said, "I'm sorry." Kyla said, "Never be sorry for that." Her hand was still on his chest. He weaved his fingers through hers. "But Callum, he's waiting for you in Talis. I don't want to—" "I loved Callum," Kyla said. "I could have been happy with him, but you still can." "No," she said, shaking her head, her curls bouncing. "He was my first love, but not my last. I have changed too much. And I don't know if I could ever look at him again, not when he'll remind me of her." Her daughter, floating forever amongst the stars. "But I have my sister," Grey said. "I don't know where my path will take me next." "It doesn't matter," Kyla said, taking Grey's stump in her other hand. "Wherever you go, I will go too." "But your father went back for you," Kyla said. "He is a practical man. He doesn't take chances like that for just anyone. He will give his blessing." Grey kissed her again, and this time they lingered much longer, letting the ship's rocking guide their movements, until they were both out of breath and laughing, holding each other closer and closer until their warmth melted together. Grey found his sister holding court at the bow of the ship. She looked perfectly at home with all the attention, her eyes bright and wide, the breeze tossing her strawberry blonde hair behind her.
"And you say the dead had the legs of a horse?"
one of the sailors asked.
"Aye,"
Shay said, spitting the word out. She was clearly mimicking the sailors, pandering to her audience.
"Which is why they were so fast."
"But they couldn't pass through stone."
Shay shook her head.
"If they could, I'd be dead."
The men laughed and slapped their knees. Shay's eyes found Grey's at the back of the crowd. She gave him a slight nod.
"And my brother would probably have been turned into one of the horsemen. But if you ask me, I think he'd be far more handsome with hind legs and a tail, don't you think?"
More raucous laughter, the men turning to greet Grey, slapping him on the back and pretending to stab him with their blades. Evidently his actions both on and off the ship had turned the tide of their respect in his favour. And yet he noticed they still wouldn't look at Kyla, the shame of their sins clearly written on their faces. Grey made his way through the crowd to where the captain sat on a barrel, watching but saying nothing, a pipe held between his lips. When Grey reached him, he stuck out his hand. The captain looked at the offering for a moment, but didn't take it. Instead, he stood to his full height, looking down at Grey with narrowed eyes. Had he seen the way Grey had been holding his daughter's hand when they'd approached? Could he still see the slight blush on Grey's cheeks? Just when Grey feared the barrel-chested man might shove him overboard, the captain pulled him into an enormous bear hug, slapping his back and squeezing.
"Now you're home, son," he said. "Now you're home."
When the general hubbub had died down and the captain had ordered his men to,
"Get back to work, ye lazy dogs,"
Gray sat next to Shay on the deck, their legs dangling between the wooden railing. Since he'd been gone, the deck had acquired a fresh layer of salt, and he was surprisingly tempted to give it a good scrubbing. But not now. The captain had exempted him from his labours indefinitely.
"Kyla is pretty," Shay said,
the edge of her lips rising playfully.
"You think so?" Gray said, avoiding her gaze. "I hadn't noticed."
Shay laughed.
"How are we here?"
"Let me tell you," Gray said. And then he did, letting the entire story pour out of him like water from a bucket, unfiltered. He made no attempt to justify his choices, and took complete responsibility for his mistakes, something he'd never have done while in Night's End. When he finished, Shay said,
"I can't believe Princess Rhea would kiss you."
Gray shook his head. "After that whole story, that's your response?"
"Yes."
Gray laughed.
"Fair enough. Sometimes I wonder what she saw in me, too. I was a rutting fool back then."
"And now?" she asked. Gray noticed she hadn't even bothered to scold his swearing. Gray smirked.
"Still a rutting fool, but working on being better."
"Gray," Shay said, and her gaze was suddenly serious.
"You are better, and you're forgiven for everything. You might have made mistakes, but that doesn't change the fact that this was the path we were meant to take."
Staring into his sister's eyes, Gray wondered when she'd gotten so wise. However, a question still stood out in his mind.
"Why did the Furia take you to the Dead Isles? Surely they knew there was great evil there. Surely they knew it was a risk."
She nodded.
"They feared they wouldn't survive, but they went anyway. They were constantly talking about the path of the Oracle. She was a woman, I guess, like them. But they spoke of her like a god, the same as when they used Roth's name. They said she'd gone to the Dead Isles and hidden something there, so they had to follow."
"The Western Oracle," Gray thought. "But she is a myth." Then again, he used to think the ghosts of the Dead Isles were a myth, too.
"What did she hide?"
"This," Shay said, and she slipped a tattered book from underneath her leg. Though the cover was grimy and breaking apart, the single word on the front was still readable, because it was carved into the wood rather than written in ink.
"Truths. While you slept, the sun dried it out, though most of what was written is lost."
Gray extended his hand and took it, idly flipping through the pages, which were wrinkled and torn, the ink smeared in illegible rivers of muck. Gray remembered the way the book had stood open on the table in the room where Shay was held prisoner. He remembered the symbol drawn inside, the same symbol that had been drawn all over his sister's skin. He scanned her arms, her legs, her feet. The markings were gone, washed away by the sea. As he moved his fingers through the ruined pages, the book fell open almost naturally to one particular page. Like the others, the words on this page had been lost to the ocean. And yet, one marking remained untouched. Impossibly untouched. It was the symbol the Furies had drawn on Shay. Half her mark, and half another mark. When joined together, they formed a golden key. His fingers brushed over the drawing.
"I don't understand what this means," he said.
He remembered something from the island, when the Fury was moments away from slitting his throat, and the dead horsemen moments away from breaking down the door. Something Shay had said to the Furies in order to save his life.
"I will tell you everything. I will tell you about the dreams."
Shay was staring at him, saying nothing.
"What have you seen in your dreams?"
he asked. Shay looked back at the ocean, squinting into the sun.
"A man," she said. "A criminal."
Gray frowned.
"What man?"
Shay fingered the spot on her hand where Gray knew her mark was hidden.
"One of the marked. Like me. His mark is the other half of mine."
A fortnight ago, Gray might have laughed her words away.
"A dream? Come on.
A hidden book titled Truths, with a weird symbol in it." He'd found more truth in his daily bowel movements.
"Messages in the stars? Hogwash.
and the Western Oracle being a real person. That was the icing on the proverbial cake. And yet, he knew exactly what this all meant, at least on the surface. "We have to find this man from your dreams," he said. Shay said, "I know." "Where do we start?" "He's a pirate," she said. "The burning sea."
"Aye."
"Pirate's peril."
"Aye."
"I'll see how far the captain is willing to take us." Gray started to rise, but Shay stopped him with a hand on his arm.
"Gray?"
"Yes?"
"Thank you for never giving up on me."
"You're welcome," he said. She released his arm, and when he turned to walk across the deck, he could see land in the distance, just before the point where the sky met the horizon. The air seemed full of plumes of dark smoke, roiling up like swift-moving storm clouds, and he swore that just below the smoke, he could see fire. Part 5. Rhone, Jai, Anise, Raven, Bane, Rhone, Rhea. Our heroes and villains must face fire and truth, which, by the reckoning of the times we live in, are forged of the same material. The Western Oracle. 43. The Western Kingdom, Night's End. Rhone, Lorraine. 1 week after capture. The door to Rhone's quarters burst open, Rhea's scarred face filling the space.
"To the tower! Now! Ironclad is going to kill himself!"
It only took him a moment to process the words before he was on his feet, rushing after his sister, simultaneously wondering if she was playing some kind of sick game with him. Still, he couldn't chance it. He flew down the corridor after Rhea. Furia were running too, their feet pounding. They reached an opening cut into the wall with a metal platform.
"Inside! Hurry!"
Rhea hissed. He stepped in beside her, breathing heavily, and several Furia crowded in beside them. The platform began to rise as a couple of burly guardsmen cranked a wheel attached to ropes. If Rhone could have stopped thinking about Gareth, he might have been impressed by the invention.
"My fault," he thought.
He had practically admitted to being in love with Gwen, while the whole time he'd missed the signs of Gareth's affections for him, reading them as a stalwart but complicated friendship. And now his friend was going to kill himself.
"My fault."
"He will only talk to you,"
Rhea said. Rhone's head jerked to the side, surprised.
"He wants me to see him do it. Oh, gods, I can't do this. I can't, I can't, I can't."
After what felt like an eternity, the lift groaned to a halt and they stepped out into a tiny stone cubicle. A stiff wind pelted him. To the right, steps descended, curving out of sight. Dead ahead was a doorway, already open, two Furia standing just inside. They looked back, their crimson hair blowing in the wind.
"Save your friend,"
Rhea commanded, pushing him forward. Rhone stumbled, but then regained his balance, stepping quickly inside the room, past the red-clad women. His eyes shot to the large window, now shattered, which explained the wind gusting inside. A lone figure stood on the edge of the window frame, his back to Rhone.
Gareth.
He's been up here the whole time, with no company but himself, his own thoughts eating him alive.
"Gareth,"
Rhone said. "This is for the best," Gareth said, not turning around.
"Let's talk.
We can work this out." His friend laughed without mirth.
"Since when have you become the optimist?"
he said into the wind.
"Since I met you,"
Rhone said.
"Not Gwen?"
"Yes, her too.
Both of you have changed me."
"You've changed me too, friend.
But this isn't about you."
"What?"
"It's not?
You are always so self-centered. Did anyone ever tell you that?"
"Yes, you broke my heart, but that wasn't your fault."
"Not really. A heart is not something that can be commanded. It chooses whomever it wishes."
"Then why are you doing this?"
"I am the shield," Gareth said.
"Remember?"
Rhone frowned, trying to understand what he was getting at.
"Not anymore. You tried to save Guy. You did your part. Are you the only one allowed a second chance? A third? I can still be the shield. If my death can make a difference, I was born to do this, and I won't be used as a weapon for your sister. If she gets her hands on Bjorn Stonesledge, the East will be doomed.
Not necessarily, Roan said. Your brother is strong, as is his army.
He remembered the defences Gareth had shown him in Faerûr. There is still hope.
Gareth finally looked back. Yes, there is. Because of me. Remember me fondly.
Roan saw the look in his friend's eyes, the goodbye, and he rushed forward, stretching out his arms, his fate mark pulsing uselessly.
Gareth jumped. Too late, 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 too late.
Light shot from his chest, a sunburst of whiteness streaming through the window, capturing Gareth's falling form in a blaze brighter than the sun at noonday. He stopped, his body frozen in midair, just outside the window. He twisted his head back and his eyes met Roan's.
How?
His expression seemed to say.
Why?
Because I love you too, Roan said. He extended his hands and pulled at the light, hand over hand, like he was hauling a rope toward him. Face full of awe and surprise, Gareth floated back inside the tower until he was able to step down, gaining his feet once more, standing in front of Roan.
You love me?
Roan nodded.
I have, for a while. But I love Gwen too. I'm sorry, I never intended this to happen. It has to be enough for now. I'm crying on the inside, a voice said from behind.
Rhea stood watching, her fury crowded behind her. Roan turned back to Gareth.
Stay strong, and never stop fighting. You are not the shield. Not any more.
He extended his arm. Gareth looked at it for a moment, and then grabbed it, pulling Roan into a hug. Seconds later, Roan was being dragged away, the door slamming in his face. Yet before he lost sight of Gareth's face, he saw the change in it. He saw the recognition. He was looking into the face of a king.
44. The Southern Empire, Fanes, Garadia Mine. Jai Jaru. 1 month after capture of the Southron Gates. The backbreaking labour was nothing to Jai. After all, he'd toiled alongside his people in Garadia for years. The only difference now was that he didn't have a choice. He was a slave. No different from the other slaves, except for the strange fact that he didn't bear the slave mark. Emperor Hoza had tried again and again to enslave him using his powers, but every time Jai's justice mark had flared on his heel, somehow protecting him from being marked. Instead, Jai dragged a heavy ball of iron everywhere he went, chained to his ankles, which were chained to each other. His hands were free, but only so he could work. At night, the mine masters cuffed his arms together, and then into a bolt hammered deep into the stone. Escape was futile. Because of Shanti and her fire root, it had taken Jai and the other slaves a fortnight to dig out Garadia, but eventually they'd succeeded. Now diamonds were flowing the same way they always did. Shanti. Just thinking her name was a dagger to his heart. He didn't know where she was, or even if she was alive. The other captured Black Tears had been enslaved and sent to Garadia too. He saw Sonika and the others from time to time, but like any other slave, they had black eyes that seemed to stare right through him. For all their efforts to save slaves, they couldn't even save themselves. Shanti hadn't been brought to Garadia for obvious reasons. She was an escaped slave. Somehow, like her father had, she'd broken the mark she'd been given as a child. The Emperor wouldn't risk her escaping again.
You can't command them to be free.
Her words from that star-speckled night on the cliffs came to him often these days. At the time, he hadn't taken much notice of them, but now they were a truth that haunted him. In the end, all he'd been to his people was another, kinder master. What if he'd never commanded them to be free, he wondered. What if he'd never met the slaves of Garadia? Would more of them be alive? Had his very presence in their lives been a death sentence? Was that what Shanti was trying to tell him? Jai shook his head, willing her face from his mind. He raised his pick, glancing around. Hundreds of black-eyed slaves worked, chipping away at the stone, searching for the next diamond. Some were familiar, faces he'd known for the last few years, faces he'd failed. Jig and Viola and Morella and even Joaquin, who had warned him about Axa. And others were new, replacements for the thousands of his people who had been killed trying to reach the Southron gates. What was it all for? Jai had always believed that a great sacrifice could save his people. By them. By him. Perhaps he would have to die for them, but as long as his death bought their freedom, he was a willing sacrifice. This was supposed to be my destiny. Instead, so many had died and he had lived. He had failed. Gritting his teeth, Jai hammered his pick into the rocks over and over until the impact was like a distant memory, fading into the background of the mine, a dull noise lost amongst the cacophony of his thoughts. Why? Was one of the unanswerable questions that kept popping up. He hated that question, because it was like asking the gods why they allowed evil in the world, or why they created a monstrous creature like a red Paizon, or why storms blew across the sea, swallowing ships whole. How? Was the other question. And Jai believed he had a pretty good handle on that one. He'd been tricked by the Emperor. When he'd been given Axa as a new slave, the Emperor had already enslaved him, had already commanded the former master to pretend to be Jai's slave, when really he was a spy the entire time. But why hadn't his justice mark warned him? He is not the enemy. Not anymore. Those were the words that filled his mind as his mark pulsed. I've been a fool. Jai had thought he was doing the right thing, giving the man a second chance. Instead, he'd played right into the Emperor's hands. The mirror trick was harder to understand. Clearly it was enchanted, though Jai had never heard of such magic. Certainly it wasn't of the gods. Perhaps the Emperor had a dark sorcerer in his employ, specializing in magical mirrors. Whatever the case, it had given Hoza the power to follow Jai and the slaves as they fled Fanes. He smashed the pick into the rocks so hard the impact vibrated into his bare chest. "Why did you wait until we were through the gates?" Jai said aloud. The question for the Emperor had churned through him for days on end, and though the answer was obvious, he kept on asking it, until it was all he could think of. Emperor Hoza had made an example of Jai, of his people. He let them get close enough to taste the fresh air of freedom on their tongues, only to snatch it away at the last second. Bastard! None of the other slaves seemed to hear him, their focus entirely on their work. The hardest part of this void he was in was being surrounded by people he loved and having them not know him from a spider on the wall. Crack! His pick hit the wall hard enough to break free several large chunks. A few of the slave children scrambled to pick them up, setting them on a flat stone and using smaller, more precise tools to break them to pieces. Jig was one of them. "Jig," Jai said. The boy chiseled at the stone, as if Jai didn't exist. His scalp was bald, his long hair hacked away after he was recaptured, as was the hair of all the men. "Jig," Jai said, louder. "It's me, Jai Jaru." Jai wondered if he was going mad. The fact that he continued to try to speak to those he once knew seemed to suggest it. As if they would magically recognize him, offering a wink and a, "Hello, Jai." A whip cracked and Jai flinched, arching his back as the sting of the blow crackled down his spine. He felt the warmth of blood rising to the surface of his skin. "Back to work, slave," the master growled, his powdered face giving him a ghostly pallor in the dim lighting. Jai fired a scathing look at the master, a man named Carvin, brought over from one of the other mines. Word was he'd coveted a spot in Garadia for a long time. "Ease off him," another voice said. Jai stared at the wall.
He didn't want to see the face of his failure, his weakness. Mindmaster Axa spoke again. "Carvin, back off. We need him unbroken if we're going to meet our quota." Carvin reluctantly moved down the line, off to harass other slaves. Jai raised his pick once more, but a strong hand caught it on the backswing. He froze, still refusing to look back.
"Jai," Axa said.
Jai said nothing. A sigh, heavy like a thick blanket.
"Why didn't you kill me when you had the chance?"
Axa asked. The man had asked the question a dozen times, but Jai had yet to answer him, and today would be no different. He hated the question, because it reflected everything he longed to forget back at him. "I was trying to do the right thing. I promised to leave no living slave behind. I thought I was being noble, giving you a second chance. I should have killed you. Maybe then I wouldn't have failed." Despite that last thought, Jai knew that if he had the chance to do it all over again, he still wouldn't have been able to kill Axa. Jai longed to hate him, but he couldn't manage even that. After all, the man had acted on Emperor Hose's command as a slave. He'd had no choice in the things he'd done, regardless of how awful they were. Jai couldn't fault him for that. And ever since, he'd been a different man. Though Emperor Hose had returned Axa's freedom and given him Garadia, he didn't act like a master any more. He wouldn't give the slaves their free will back, as Jai had once done, but he treated them with respect and often protected them from the whips of the other mine masters. He didn't even powder his face any more. Not while in Garadia, at least, a detail that was not lost on Jai. Typically when Jai ignored Axa, the mine master would move on. But not today. This time Axa leaned closer, until Jai could feel his hot breath on the back of his neck.
"I have a plan,"
Axa whispered in his ear. Jai didn't move, didn't breathe, didn't speak.
"Ever since I was... since I felt what it was like to be controlled, to be owned, I can't get the memories out of my head. They're like waking nightmares. I can remember everything, and yet it's like it was happening to a different person, some stranger."
Jai said nothing.
"I will save you,"
Axa said. Finally, Jai spoke. "I don't want to be saved. I don't deserve to be saved. I deserve to be here, slaving for the rest of my days until I die. Save the rest of them if you want your conscience to be clean." Axa backed up a step, and Jai felt like he could breathe again.
"My conscience will never be clean. But I will do this thing. I will do what I can for the slaves in Garadia."
Jai raised his pick and swung it as hard as he could. 45. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Anis Garrick. 1 month after retaking the castle. The decision had been made a fortnight earlier, and now finally it was the eve before their journey north, into the unexplored hinterlands, chasing after a legend. Anis felt alive, ready, and she was sorely tempted to leave immediately in the dark of night. Of course she wouldn't, for with no sunlight, the cold alone would do them in within a few hours. Castle Hill would be left under the rule of Queen Regent Zelda, who had Anise's full authority. She knew the kingdom was in good hands. Anis only hoped her aunt wouldn't be forced to face an invasion in her absence. Though Sir Dietrich, Sir Metz, and Sir Jonas had begun a soldier training academy, the soldiers in training, most of whom had never held more than a spatula or hammer before, were still eons away from being battle-ready. The number of volunteers, however, was staggering, especially since Anise had allowed women to enroll. Only a tenth of the trainees were women thus far, but she was certain the proportion would rise. Anise thought of Taryn often, especially at night, when she huddled under the covers trying to stay warm. Sometimes she imagined him tucked against her, his lips close enough that she could feel his breath on her skin. Sometimes her heart ached so much she thought for certain it would shatter, closing off her airways. But it never did. And when she awoke each morning, she cast the memories away along with her quilt.
Her love for him was still as bright as a flame, but she wouldn't let it consume her to the point where it would hurt her ability to rule, to care for her people. Terin, as he'd promised in his letter, had not returned, and Anis suspected he never would. She couldn't hate him for leaving her, not when his reasons were so pure, so full of love for her. He'd sacrificed as much as she had. If anything, they were both martyrs. Besides his goodbye message, she'd found a stack of parchment hidden in the chamber. On it was written stories in Terin's handwriting. Stories about his life, from the point after his parents had faked his death. Just as he'd promised. Anise had them tucked away in a box under her bed. She had yet to read any of them. She wasn't certain when she would be able to do so without shattering. Now, Anise rose from her bed and shuffled across the cold stone floor to where Archer slept peacefully, a candle lit by his bedside, slowly melting down to just a nub. As she'd commanded, one of the castle maids would come by to replace the candle before it was completely gone. Although the ritual sometimes made her feel silly and superstitious, she refused to abandon it, not while her brother remained alive, as if he would pass into the night the moment his candle went out. For a while, Anise watched Arch breathe, his face so calm, so undisturbed. She wondered whether it was better that he'd slept through all the bad that had happened. At least she could protect him from the pain. He stirred in his sleep, as he often did. Anise used to feel a leap in her chest, but not any more. Now she just watched as his lips twitched, his eyelids fluttered. She reached down and held his hand.
"Brother, tomorrow I'll be leaving. I don't know if I shall ever return. But you will be safe, I promise. Aunt Zelda will care for you."
She paused as his face went still and peaceful once more.
"Archer, I love you."
His hand squeezed hers, and she froze for a moment, before letting out a breathy laugh. He'd never done that before, and for a second she thought he might. His eyelids fluttered open. He blinked. His lips opened.
"I love you too, Anise,"
he murmured. And then his eyes closed and his chest rose and fell as if he'd never awoken in the first place. 46. The Southern Empire, Calypso. Raven Sands. 4 days after the battle at the Southron Gates. Raven had ridden Heyron all the way back to Calypso, stopping only twice for the dragon to rest and eat. Now, as she watched Whisper emerge from her quarters, Raven almost wished she'd taken more time, delaying this reunion so she could think more about what to say. "She's so beautiful," Raven thought. "So pure." Whisper wore a pink, ankle-length dress with a silky red lumia flower stitched into the shoulder. "She doesn't deserve so much heartache in her life." The moment her sister's eyes rose from her feet and she saw Raven approaching, Whisper raced across the courtyard, flinging herself into Raven's arms. Raven held her to her chest, squeezing as hard as she dared, breathing, crying, kissing her cheeks. Whisper was crying too, and yet she said,
"You're crying."
Raven had never cried in front of her before. The youngest Sand's head craned to look past Raven.
"Where is Fire? Couldn't she have met me at the same time?"
Raven bit her lip. Whisper's eyes darted back to meet hers.
"Raven?"
"I'm so sorry. I did everything I could to."
Whisper squirmed out of her sister's arms, backing away, her eyes wild.
"I knew it. I knew it from the moment you left."
There was the sharp bite of anger in her voice, which also trembled with sadness.
"And when the tree burned down?"
She whirled around and raced back to her quarters, flinging herself through the door of hanging bones. Raven started after her, but stopped when the last thing her sister said came into focus.
"What about the tree?"
Her eyes darted left, to where the unburning tree should have been.
"No,"
she breathed. The tree was gone, like Fire, burned to ash. 1 month later. As Raven sat upon the Dragon Throne, streams continued to arrive from the northern edges of Dragon Bay, as well as from the northeastern dunes of the Skara. None of the reports were good. The Eastern Army was killing and pillaging Calypsian nomads at will. Twice Raven had sent platoons of peacekeepers, but none had returned thus far. Raven was Empress.